Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org on Facebook and Twitter, and on your YouTube channel. This program is also being held in association with the Asia Society of Northern California. I'm Philip Yun, Executive Director of the Plowshares Fund, and your moderator for today. And today we welcome to our program our distinguished speaker, Assistant Secretary of State Danny Russell. It will come as no surprise to most of you in this California-based audience when I say that in this age of globalization, the interests and future of the United States is inextricably linked to the prosperity, stability, and security of the Asia Pacific. We here have long been aware of the region's dynamism. Over half the world's population resides in the Asia Pacific. By some calculations, the region accounts for nearly 60% of the world's economic output. It also has some of the world's largest standing militaries. The opportunity is vast, as many in the San Francisco and Silicon Valley business and tech community will tell you and have taken advantage of. But with this opportunity, there are significant challenges too. Most recently, there is an uneasiness about the increasingly tough exchanges between China and countries ranging from Japan and South Korea in the north to the Philippines, Malaysia, and Vietnam in the south. As the dominant power in the Pacific, just how tough is the United States prepared to be with a rising China? There are also international concerns about North Korea's ongoing nuclear weapon program, its string of missile tests this year, and its atrocious human rights abuses, as recently reported in a landmark UN report. On the economic side, some seem to feel that the push for the TPP, a free trade pact between the U.S. and 11 Asia-Pacific countries, is stalling and are worried about the consequences of failure. These are just some of the many difficult issues that our guest, Danny Russell, deals with every day. Danny is the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs. He is a career member of the Foreign Service. Prior to his appointment as Assistant Secretary of State, Danny served as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Asian Affairs at the National Security Council. I won't detail the number of important postings he has had in his career. And in fact, we first met when he was the Chief of Staff for Undersecretary Tom Pickering. What I can tell you and what I will tell you about Danny is that he embodies the best of the Foreign Service. He's smart, practical, dedicated, and he has a love of country non-parallel. And now, I am pleased to introduce our distinguished speaker, Danny Russell, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs. Please welcome Mr. Russell.
Well, thank you all. Thank you very much, Phil, for the introduction. I'm really glad to be in San Francisco. I'm glad to be with all of you here at the Commonwealth Club, and I very much appreciate the organizers for creating this opportunity. I myself lived in San Francisco for a while after college, and it was while I lived in San Francisco that I became first so interested in Asia. It was also from San Francisco that I traveled to Japan and wound up living there for 3 years and ultimately pursuing a career in the U.S. Foreign Service. I think you're here because you understand the importance of Asia to America. It's especially evident in a Pacific coast state like California, as you heard from Phil. And I'd add that more than 5.5 million Asia-Pacific Americans live in California, and millions more Californians do business, study, or otherwise benefit from ties with the Asia-Pacific region. California exported nearly $70 billion in goods to the region last year, more than any other state. And Asia matters not just to California, but to the United States, to our economy, to our security, to our families. So as a Pacific power and a trading nation, my view is we can't afford not to be in the Asia-Pacific region. And it's not only my view. That's exactly why President Obama decided, even during the transition before he had formally taken office, to institute a long-term strategic emphasis on this region. And I'm confident that that emphasis will extend far beyond President Obama's presidency. Why? Because we have strong bipartisan support for it. Both parties in Congress understand fully the tremendous importance of Asia to the interests of the United States. Now, as Phil alluded to, there's a lot going on in Asia today, from the dramatic rise of China and the historic reforms in Burma, to the ongoing threat from North Korea's pursuit of nuclear weapons, to the dangerous tensions in the South China Sea. And while I know that, as a topic, the subject strengthening regional institutions sounds very bureaucratic, probably ties for last place along with corporate tax policy and things like that, doesn't have a lot of headline-grabbing power. The fact is that strengthening regional institutions is one of our most consequential undertakings in terms of U.S. interests. And what I'd like to focus on with you today in my remarks, namely the effort to shape a rules-based order that's stable, that's peaceful, that's open, and free, is because of the importance that we place on regional institutions. First, by way of background, let me say that the region that I'm responsible for, East Asia and the Pacific, is a very diverse one. We've got Northeast Asia, we've got Oceania, which includes Australia, New Zealand, the Pacific Island states, and then we have Southeast Asia, and they're all quite different. Starting in Northeast Asia, just briefly, obviously it's the home of our two most important treaty allies, Japan and the Republic of Korea. We've modernized our defense cooperation with both countries to address the very real threat posed by North Korea. And we've deepened economic engagement through free trade agreements, such as the one we reached with the Republic of Korea, the CORUS FTA. Northeast Asia is also home, of course, to China, with which we've dramatically increased our engagement. I was with Secretary Kerry and Secretary of the Treasury, Jack Lew, and a number of other cabinet members just earlier this month at the annual strategic and economic dialogue. This is an annual dialogue that covers nearly every area of our relationship with China, from concrete steps to combat climate change and wildlife trafficking, to preventing nuclear proliferation from the Korean Peninsula or from Iran, to facilitating business and investment between the two countries and the region. The extent and the depth of these exchanges show the conviction of both sides as the two world's largest economies, two of the strongest military powers, and I should add, the two largest carbon emitters. It shows the conviction of both sides to cooperate on the world's toughest problems wherever we can. And just as important, these exchanges show our shared commitment to tackle problems frankly and openly, instead of just agreeing to disagree on issues like human rights, on issues like protection of intellectual property. So to speak just for a moment about the other region, before I turn to Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific Island states are extremely important partners as well. The U.S. has upgraded our defense cooperation with our important treaty ally, Australia, and we're working to create jobs and shared prosperity with both Australia and New Zealand through the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP trade agreement that the administration is hard at work on. We're also working closely with the vulnerable island states in the Pacific to protect the environment. Last month, Secretary Kerry hosted an unprecedented Our Oceans Conference, a first-of-a-kind diplomatic effort that rallied heads of state and scientists and advocates from the Pacific Island nations and beyond to get together to discuss programs and ways to protect the shared resource of the oceans. But in many respects, the dynamic center of the Asia-Pacific region is Southeast Asia and the 10 countries that make up ASEAN. And let me, if I may, just at the outset say a few words briefly about each one of them. Our ally, the Philippines, is a stable democracy with strong economic growth. We completed an enhanced defense cooperation agreement during President Obama's visit in April, which enables us to better address common security challenges and provide relief for disasters, such as we did in the wake of Super Typhoon Haiyan recently. Our economies also continue to grow closer, with two-way trade with the Philippines reaching $24 billion last year. We have strong partners in Indonesia and Malaysia, both pluralistic and tolerant Muslim-majority nations with fast-growing economies. Indonesia's recent presidential election shows the strength of its democracy. And President Obama's recent visit to Malaysia in April highlighted our growing economic and people-to-people and security ties. Singapore is an influential and an effective economic, diplomatic, and security partner for the United States. Nearby, Brunei is a major energy producer that, while small, has been a valuable partner for us on crucial regional issues like renewable energy and free trade. And Vietnam, of course, has an immensely complicated history with the United States, but our relations are now flourishing. Trade is increasing dramatically as Vietnam's economy grows, and we're forging closer security ties, even as we encourage greater political openness and respect for human rights. The U.S. cooperates with Laos and with Cambodia on a range of development issues, and we also urge them to adhere to global standards of human rights. We were gratified to see just this week that the opposition, led by Samransi, is finally in a position to reclaim its place in the Cambodian parliament. And with our longtime treaty ally, Thailand, despite the recent setback of a military coup, we remain committed, deeply committed, to our enduring friendship and partnership. But perhaps no other country shows the promise of the Southeast Asia region better than the current chair of ASEAN in 2014, Burma, Myanmar, which has made a turn of historic proportions towards democracy and reform. But that turn is by no means complete and no means assured. Burma faces daunting challenges, and the success of its reform process is not a foreordained conclusion. Burma's working hard to negotiate a lasting peace to end the world's longest-running civil war, something like 17 armed insurgencies that have been underway for many decades. Burma is grappling now with the key issue of constitutional reform, of military versus civilian control over the government, and of who can be eligible to serve as the head of state. And the Burmese government continues to face very difficult choices in determining what it can do to help resolve a long-standing and ongoing humanitarian crisis in Rakhine State. Now, on that important issue, we have seen some positive movement in just the last week. The Burmese government announced its intent to welcome the return of assistance providers like Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, and has put forth its strategy on how to bring access to livelihood and security back to the populations in Rakhine State that have been living in such tenuous circumstances for so many months because of the ethnic and the religious violence and discrimination in that region. Secretary Kerry will be very focused on seeing how this process is proceeding when he visits Burma in early August, in just a few weeks. Secretary Kerry, and then later in the year, President Obama, when the president visits in November for the annual ASEAN summit, which moves according to the chairmanship of ASEAN, will be keen to get a sense of Burma's preparedness for its landmark elections next year. The world will be watching, and we will help, and we will continue to stand with the people of Burma as they enter this testing period. So we'll continue to press Burma's leaders to protect and respect all of their people and all of the human rights and fundamental freedoms. And we will continue to support that country's transformation. So what I've done is a very quick overview of where Southeast Asia stands at the moment. The region's economic dynamism, its strategic importance, has made it a particular focus of the Obama administration. And over the last five, now 6 years, I guess you could say that there's a rebalancing occurring within the broader U.S. rebalance towards the Asia-Pacific region. The 10 countries that I've mentioned have a lot of differences among them, but they're bound by the conviction that they can achieve more together than they can apart. I'd like to talk about where those countries are headed, but first, it's worth recalling how it is that they came together. Today's ASEAN began in 1967 when the Vietnam War was heating up and the Cold War seemed like it would never end. In that uncertain era, five Southeast Asian nations signed a declaration that they would support each other as they each sought together to build prosperous but independent states. Now, nearly a half century after its founding, ASEAN has doubled to 10 nations with more than 620 million people and a GDP of $2.2 trillion. And as Southeast Asia has grown and developed, ASEAN's relations with the U.S. have grown as well. Under our Trade and Investment Framework Agreement, signed in 2006, we've significantly deepened our economic ties. And since President Obama decided in 2009 to sign the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation, this is a treaty that ASEAN has extended to key neighbors, we've deepened our political ties as well. This is shown by the president's decision to participate every year in the East Asia Summit, as he will again in November. And this commitment to enhanced engagement with ASEAN is a key feature of the rebalance and of our overall strategy towards the region. We're also strengthening our ties with ASEAN across the entire U.S. government, not just on the diplomatic side. Take this past April when Secretary Hagel, Secretary of Defense, along with the U.S. Pacific Commander, Admiral Locklear, and interestingly, the administrator of our USAID, Agency for International Development, Raj Shah, hosted defense ministers from the 10 ASEAN nations in Hawaii. This was the first ever defense ministerial ASEAN U.S. Event in the United States, a recognition that our security and prosperity are more intertwined than ever before. Let me give you an example. California, for instance, already sells over $11.6 billion in worth of goods to the ASEAN countries alone. Exports to ASEAN support more than 90,000 California jobs. And both those numbers can, should, and I hope will grow a lot more. California has a lot to gain from more tourists, more students, more exchanges with the region. But as I said, Asia and ASEAN matter not just to the Pacific states, but to the United States. We had a $206 billion trade in goods banner year last year. ASEAN is our fourth largest export market and trading partner. And with a diaspora reaching all across America, the Asia-Pacific region contributes to our culture and our nation. And of course, sitting astride vital trade routes, as the region does, it's hugely important to American security. So a stable Southeast Asia that meets the aspirations of its people, the aspirations for economic growth, for clean air and water, for education, for food security, and for a voice in how they are governed. That kind of Southeast Asia is very much in America's national interest. And one of the best and most efficient ways for America to help the region meet those aspirations is the work that we do investing in ASEAN. Because strengthening regional institutions is an important long-term strategy. We pursue it because it's essential to building the foundations for progress, from ease of trade and travel and transport to systems for resolving legal disputes, to the ability to act together on pressing issues like environmental degradation or protection. We all benefit from a rules-based system. And it's my experience as a diplomat that strong institutions harness a very powerful force, a force you see both in daily life and in international relations. That's peer pressure. In fact, ASEAN shows that the best way to create a positive dynamic, a positive peer pressure in the long term, is by building strong institutions. And so ASEAN is working now towards forming a cohesive economic community by the end of next year. And they're doing it through efforts to lower barriers, to synchronize procedures, so that they can increase trade volumes with one another and collectively with other parts of the world. For the U.S. economy, that ASEAN integration, that economic community, that single window, will mean easier and more efficient market access to all 10 of the ASEAN countries. And in the longer term, of course, a more prosperous ASEAN will be able to buy more American exports, from farm products to manufactured goods to services. But even as ASEAN pursues its ambitious agenda of internal integration, it's taken on the challenge of helping to bring the entire Asia-Pacific region closer together. And this fills an important gap. APEC is a forum for economic cooperation, but there had been no forum in the region where countries could deal with political, security, and humanitarian issues. So in 1997, ASEAN started holding meetings first with Japan and South Korea and with China, and then with Australia and India and New Zealand. And then 4 years ago, with the United States and Russia, bringing the number of world leaders attending what I mentioned earlier, the East Asia Summit, to a total of 18. And the growth of this forum, the East Asia Summit, shows ASEAN's measured advance on the international stage as a hub that connects the region. Less visible than the Leaders' Summit, but even larger, is something called the ASEAN Regional Forum. This is an annual gathering of foreign ministers representing 26 countries, all the way from Pakistan to the Pacific Rim, and including a representative from the EU as well. This, I'd say, is perhaps the region's most important ministerial meeting of the year, and it will be held in just a couple of weeks in Burma. Secretary Kerry will be able to discuss with his counterpart political and security issues. They'll be able to begin fleshing out the agenda for the East Asia Summit, the EAS, which President Obama plans to attend in November, as I just mentioned. Why the emphasis by the U.S. on these institutions, on the EAS, for example? Well, you know, in Europe, we've seen for decades how a region can develop effective institutions tailored to its unique needs. NATO, the OSCE, there are other good examples in Europe. Those organizations have helped to tackle regional political, security, and humanitarian problems. And we believe that the EAS can and should become the premier forum for addressing pressing issues in the Asia-Pacific region as well. But it's relatively new, and its members are still trying to shape it to increase its usefulness and effectiveness. The United States joined the EAS because, as a Pacific nation, we want to be at the table for a strategic discussion about how we build and shape the institution and the region over time. Let me give you a little preview of some of the issues that will be high on Secretary Kerry's agenda. We expect to advance collaboration on quite a few issues, ranging from non-proliferation to humanitarian assistance and disaster relief. And disaster response is incredibly important, since the Asia-Pacific region is hit by something like 70% of all of the world's natural disasters. And those disasters cost the region some $68 billion annually each year over the past 10 years. So we've worked very closely with our partners, including with China, on improving regional responses to a whole range of environmental and natural disaster-related problems and accidents such as oil spills. We support an ASEAN declaration on rapid disaster response. We're helping to spread the lessons learned in the Philippines from the recent super typhoon Haiyan. And we're working to improve the capabilities of ASEAN's Center for Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Relief. We've also teamed up with regional partners to develop a strategic plan for exercises that will prepare us better to coordinate the delivery of life-saving relief in future emergencies. And we're preparing to host ARF climate change adaptation workshop to help countries protect their people from this growing problem. In advancing these areas of collaboration, we have frank discussions about pressing political and security challenges as well. And in recent months, the main security challenge facing ASEAN has been the tensions in the South China Sea over conflicting claims to territory. This is, of course, the most important issue for the countries who themselves have overlapping territorial and maritime claims there. And I'd like to be upfront that the United States is not a claimant. The United States does not take a position on other countries' claims to land features in the South China Sea. And the United States doesn't benefit from resolution in one way or another as long as it's peaceful. So the United States can be impartial, and we are impartial. We're not taking one claimant's side against another's. But peace and stability in the South China Sea is important to the United States. It's important to the international community, because the South China Sea is essential to the global economy. Up to 50% of the world's oil tanker shipments and more than 50% of the world's merchant tonnage pass through the sea lanes in the South China Sea. Moreover, global interests like freedom of navigation, respect for international law, and the peaceful settlement of disputes, the protection of unimpeded lawful commerce, these interests are at stake and they are U.S. national interests. Now, the rival territorial maritime claims have existed in this region for decades. Countries have jostled over islands, over shipping lanes, over historically rich fisheries, and more recently, important marine resources like oil and gas reserves. The claimants have at various times shown that cooperation in the South China Sea area is possible. They've jointly explored for and managed resources. The Philippines and Indonesia, for example, recently and peacefully settled a 20-year maritime boundary dispute just outside the sea. China and Vietnam in the past have settled similar issues. And some claimants have jointly developed energy resources further away from disputed land features. In 2002, the ASEAN nations and China signed what they called a Declaration on Conduct in the South China Sea. This declaration, among other things, said that the parties would resolve disputes peacefully in accordance with international law, and they would refrain from actions that would escalate disputes, such as setting up new outposts on unoccupied land features in the South China Sea. And they agreed to work towards a more detailed, formalized code of conduct that would limit and regulate behavior. But tensions have flared over the years as well, and this year they are running high. No one claimant is solely responsible for the state of the tensions. However, big and strong countries have a special responsibility to show restraint. China's recent pattern of assertive unilateral behavior has raised serious concerns in the region, concerns about China's expansive claims, concerns about China's willingness to adhere to international law and standards. Tensions recently spiked, as you know from the news, when China sent a deep water drilling rig and armed ships into an area near the Paracel Islands that Vietnam also claims. The resulting weeks-long confrontation resulted in damaged ships, including the sinking of a Vietnamese fishing vessel, and damaged relations, including anti-Chinese riots in Vietnam that were very destructive. At the same time, public evidence indicates that the claimants are upgrading outposts on small land features in the South China Sea. What worries me is that China's projects are far outpacing similar upgrades that other claimants are making. This important, resource-rich area shouldn't be heavily militarized. Actions off the water can raise tensions as well. Now, the United States believes firmly that all parties should be able to bring disputes for adjudication under international law if they conclude that regular diplomatic efforts aren't yielding success. The Philippines has done this in a dispute with China over the validity of China's claim that an old 1948 nationalist Chinese map somehow proves that China owns the land and the water within the nine-dash line in the South China Sea. But instead of engaging in a constructive way by arguing its case at court, which is something the international tribunal that's examining this case has invited China to do, the Chinese have been pressuring the Philippines to drop its case, and they've attempted to isolate the Philippines diplomatically. But international law, not national power, should be the basis for pursuing maritime claims in the South China Sea. The United States, therefore, is working to lower tensions and to help the parties peacefully manage their disputes. And we're doing it in a number of ways. We've told the claimants, including the Chinese, directly and at high levels of our growing concern, and we've encouraged all sides to avoid provocative steps and to clarify their claims based on international law. We're working with ASEAN and others in the international community to promote regional structures and arrangements like a meaningful code of conduct to lower tensions and manage disputes. Rules and guidelines work best when they're agreed to by the parties through institutions that build habits of cooperation. The U.S. is also investing more than $150 million in the civilian maritime capabilities of allies and partners in the area over the next 2 years. That includes equipment and training and infrastructure. And it augments our own security presence in the region, which has been enhanced by the steady U.S. rebalance. So these are some of the steps that the U.S. is taking, but it's the claimants who are the ones who must manage and settle the disputes. They're the ones who have to generate the peer pressure, and they're the ones who have to hold themselves to high standards and set good examples for one another. For example, as I mentioned, China and ASEAN already committed under the 2002 Declaration of Conduct to avoid activities that would complicate or escalate disputes and affect peace and stability. However, these problematic activities aren't well defined. So we're urging China and the other claimants to have a conversation about what activities are acceptable and what are unacceptable to each of them, both to help reduce tensions now and to manage differences in the long run. We've called for claimant states to define and voluntarily freeze problematic activities. We think the exact elements of a freeze should be decided by consensus among the claimants. And a freeze, an agreement, would not prejudice their respective competing claims for sovereignty. It would just help govern behavior. So we've advanced these ideas in detail, in public and more specifically in private, and we intend to advance this important discussion on the upcoming forum that Secretary Kerry will be attending in Burma. So I know I've gone on long. Let me just say that over time, strong institutions can influence the conduct of all members, can help avoid conflict, and can help incentivize peaceful resolution of disputes. We see this positive peer pressure on problems like environmental issues, in trade, in dealing with human rights. It doesn't work every time, but it can generate enormous progress. The Asia-Pacific region has almost limitless potential if it can avoid the pitfalls ahead. Strong institutions are key, not just to avoiding and resolving disputes, but also to lowering barriers to trade and protecting human and fundamental freedoms. So the U.S., as a resident Pacific power and as an active participant or leader in many of the region's institutions, will do all we can to strengthen these values and strengthen these institutions. And we do it through our alliances and our security partnerships, and we do it through our growing business and people-to-people ties. California plays an incredibly important role in that context. So we think that the U.S. government, the U.S. people, working together can and will continue to provide a foundation of peace and stability on which the region can grow. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Danny Russell, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs. And now it's time to take some of our audience's questions. We have a number of them, and as I said, I apologize if I'm not going to be able to get to them, but your remarks have generated a lot of interest. So let's stay with the South China Sea. We had a lot of questions that relate to the U.S. position, which you explained very clearly, but actually there were a couple of questions that said, does the United States have a red line? Is there something that the United States absolutely will not tolerate? And what are your, you know, then in that case, what do you think the United States might do? We're asking a hypothetical, which I know is very difficult, but maybe you can help us a little bit to think about it.
Well, I think rather than talk about the red lines, that I'd like to focus on what it is that we're trying to achieve. What we want is for the phenomenal resources of the Asia-Pacific region, specifically of the South China Sea, to be available in a responsible way, in a sustainable way, to the people of Southeast Asia. And so the issue is not which rock belongs to which country. The issue is what kind of region will it be? How will the countries interact? And how will those resources, whether it's fisheries, whether it's access to sea and air, whether it's the undersea hydrocarbon, oil and gas, or whether it's the phenomenal unexploited mineral and natural wealth, or whether it is the precious and endangered stock of things like coral and giant clams and other maritime wildlife that is being threatened. How will that be used? So our efforts are, in the first instance, diplomatic. We are not in a physical or a military struggle with China. We are not in. We are not defending U.S. territory, although we certainly have defense treaties with a number of the countries, and the United States takes its commitments to the security of our allies very seriously. But we're using diplomatic tools. As I mentioned, one of them is institution building, but another is the impact of our bilateral engagement. We deal directly with all of the claimants in the South China Sea. It is with the Philippines and Vietnam, with Malaysia and Brunei, with China as well. And in the East China Sea, of course, where the Chinese are beginning to make a strong claim for sovereignty in the Senkaku Islands, which Japan has administered since 1972 when the U.S. Turned them over along with Okinawa, we talk directly and actively both to Japan and China. There is no acceptable alternative to peaceful resolution. Okay. And for that reason, a good deal of our focus, in addition to the diplomatic piece, is on mechanisms that the claimants and the countries in the region can put into place to avoid incidents that could spiral into a crisis.
So I think the audience and I appreciate your spending a lot of time and emphasizing ASEAN. As a country, as a region, Southeast Asia, I think it's very easy to focus on China and Japan and North Korea because those are sort of the things that come out in the media, and then you're starting to bring this out. So a lot of the questions we had also focused essentially, had to do with China as a rising power. Some categorized it as a power that's trying to change the status quo, in which the United States and others are protectors of, so to speak. So maybe I ask the question this way. Can ASEAN help in sort of making China's rise something that's going to be not as disruptive as it possibly could be? And is that possibly one of the reasons why we're focusing on this response?
Absolutely. I think that ASEAN has an important role in helping to shape the rise of China in a way that ensures that it contributes, not detracts from the long-term stability and the long-term economic prosperity of the entire region and, frankly, the globe. And it can do it in a number of ways. The one that I've spent the most time discussing, of course, is by creating a platform, a forum at which all countries, including China and the United States, who have a presence and a set of interests in the Pacific, can interact and can collaborate on problem solving and working through difficult issues and on practical cooperation and constructive partnership. They, in their bilateral relations with China and in the broader ASEAN-China venue, negotiate a wide range of agreements that are important in setting a course for China that will generate the kind of peaceful periphery that China's new leader, Xi Jinping, has publicly stated that he's seeking to build. But at the heart of it, what I'd like to emphasize is that U.S. policy welcomes a stable China, welcomes a prospering China, and welcomes a growing China. But we want that China to be a contributor to the well-being of the entire region, not a destabilizing force. So we do not, as the United States, insist that the status quo is immutable. To the contrary, we have been adapting and modernizing our own relationships and our alliances to meet the challenges of the 21st century. The United States has been the country that has encouraged and helped to create space for China, given China a seat at the table in international and regional rules making. We welcome that, but on the condition that China, like us, like others, accept that rulemaking is not unilateral, and that rules are binding on all of us, not just on the other guy.
So you, I think, while you are at the White House, had a lot to do with the rebalancing policy. And here's an opportunity, I think, for you to talk a little bit more about that. There are some people who say that the whole rebalancing piece is really focused on China. And you've talked a little bit about that. An opportunity for you to clarify a little bit more on that for us, too.
Thank you very much, Phil. I was lucky enough to be loaned by the State Department to the National Security Council in January of 2009, and I'm not a political partisan person. I'm a career civil servant. But I started at the very beginning of a presidential administration and was able to see what the objectives the president and his top advisors brought with them. And it was clear to me that they felt that the U.S. was underinvested in the important Asia-Pacific region. It was clear that they felt that America's security and economic interests were deeply tied to the future of the Asia-Pacific, and therefore they wanted to be an active part of it. I heard the president say, we need to roll up our sleeves and get into the business of helping to shape the region. And he laid out a number of priorities. First and foremost, to strengthen America's alliance relationships. And that includes with Japan, the Republic of Korea, with Australia, with the Philippines, with Thailand, and also other important security partnerships. Our bilateral relationships need to be good. And I would argue that our alliances and our bilateral relationships in Asia are better now than perhaps at any time in recent memory. Secondly, he made a priority of participating in and helping to strengthen regional institutions, and that's what I've been talking about. Thirdly, he prioritized American engagement and support for the new emerging powers. China, first and foremost, and the president has had a tremendous amount, the entire cabinet has had a tremendous amount of direct engagement with China over the last 5 years, but also with important partners like Indonesia and like India. He put a tremendous emphasis on our economic ties with the region, and that's responsible for the push to establish new and really high-quality free trade agreements that will create good markets for American products and services, jobs at home, but also bolster the prosperity of the entire region and therefore the globe. And then lastly, the president set out as part of our rebalance strategy active support for the universal freedoms that matter not only to Americans but to human beings. The freedoms, the ability to shape one's own political future, the ability to organize, the ability to speak freely. These are values that are at the heart of economic success, and there are values that are at the heart of good governance and social stability. These are the component parts of our rebalance.
Okay. So we've talked a little bit about, we've talked about China. Let's talk about Japan a little bit. There was a question related to what's going on now with Prime Minister Abe, the efforts to, I guess, reinterpret the Constitution, Article 9, about the renunciation of war. Are there concerns? Tell us what the region is thinking about, what the U.S. perspective is on what's going on, because I think it really is shaping the larger picture of some of the things that we're seeing right now with respect to some of the conflicts as well.
Well, the first principle here is that the contributions that Japan has made and does make and hopes to make to security in the Asia-Pacific region more broadly are made in the context of the U.S.-Japan alliance. We operate as a very closely knit, interoperable alliance. And so in that context, for the Japanese people and government to make a decision to expand their ability to participate actively in regional peace and security through what they call, or what is called, the right of collective self-defense, something that's enshrined in the UN Charter, but that historically modern Japan has refrained from exercising. If the Japanese government and people ultimately follow through on the decision to do more under collective self-defense within the confines of the U.S.-Japan alliance, that is a net plus for all of us. Now, what the U.S. has consistently advocated and what the Japanese government has been careful to do is to ensure that the process of their deliberations is a transparent one. So the outcomes and decisions don't come as any surprise, and they are, we hope, less vulnerable to being misunderstood. Obviously, Japan has a tremendously difficult old history, 20th century history, with its neighbors, and that requires tremendous sensitivity in the first instance on Japan's part, but also care by its neighbors. But over the last 70 years, Japanese self-defense forces have not fired a shot in anger, and Japan, true to its pacifist constitution, has been an important force for peaceful resolution of issues.
This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking with Danny Russell, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs. I'm Philip Young, your moderator. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, and see program videos on our YouTube channel. So we've talked about China, we've talked about Japan. Let's pull on the question that you just talked about with this, the potential, the friction between China and Japan, two major powers in the Asia-Pacific region, an ally, a close ally of the United States. How concerned are you that something at the disputes that are going on can erupt into something that is just more than rhetoric? And in a sense, what are you all doing to, one of the questions was, how can the U.S. help improve relations between China and Japan?
Well, the global economy is too important and too fragile for the world's second and third largest economies to be at odds. We need Japan and China, and frankly, both of them need to be cooperating, be expanding ties, not competing, certainly not on a military platform. There is a risk always of an incident that would spiral quickly out of control. And one of the things that the United States is doing is the effort to promote confidence-building measures and crisis prevention and crisis management mechanisms, most recently through an agreement on something called the Code for Unplanned Encounters at Sea, namely training militaries to understand how to deal with the unexpected in a peaceful and in a careful way. Now, as it happens, Japan and China have very, very well-trained and very experienced professionals in their respective defense establishments. But the risk is not zero, and the consequences of an incident are far too great to ignore. And the Japanese Prime Minister Abe, has advocated for and, in fact, has called for things like hotlines, things like rules of engagement that could be agreed upon between Japan and China to prevent those incidents. But fundamentally and longer term, there has to be direct political engagement and an increase in diplomatic dialogue between Beijing and Japan. They have far more in common than they have differences, and we believe that it is both possible and necessary for their political leaders to work together on behalf of both countries and the region.
Let's then move on to, we've talked about Japan, China. Let's talk about Korea for right now. How realistic is a North Korea? What is the actual threat of North Korea to the United States? And what is it that you're concerned about?
Well, one of my greatest concerns, Phil, is the ongoing effort by the North Koreans, the DPRK, in pursuit of a nuclear weapon that could be miniaturized and placed on a warhead on an intercontinental missile, on a ballistic missile. The UN Security Council, through repeated resolutions, has expressly and forcefully condemned and warned North Korea against both the nuclear and the ballistic missile program. And North Korea is in defiance of and in violation not only of those international laws, but also of its own commitments reached through negotiations. What we've tried to do is two things. On the one hand, through very close coordination with both our treaty allies, Japan and the Republic of Korea, but also by diplomatic efforts, principally with China, we have tried to create a unified front so that North Korea simply will not find a gap or an opening that it can exploit to try to break apart the international consensus that North Korea has to denuclearize. The second thing, though, that we have done, not including our defense measures to protect ourselves from a ballistic missile and to protect Japan and Korea from other kinds of provocation, is on the diplomatic front to make clear repeatedly to North Korea that all of the benefits that will accrue to North Korea from a peaceful resolution, from denuclearization, are there on the table. That the United States is not out to crush the DPRK. We want the DPRK, we want the North Koreans, to move into compliance with international standards. And that by doing so, not only can they achieve some of the economic cooperation and the diplomatic recognition that North Korea has consistently said it wants, but by doing so, they can achieve the security that they also need. There's no security to be had from a program to enrich uranium, to reprocess plutonium. That creates insecurity for North Korea, not safety.
Let's talk about you and I were talking earlier about U.S. engagement in the region. Mm-hmm. And there was a really interesting question that talked about how do we make it credible for China, ASEAN, our allies, that the U.S. has a core interest in East Asia? If the interest is not credible, then China, as an example, would tend to miscalculate. ASEAN and some of our allies would have a fear of desertion. How concerned are you about that? When you go all around the region, are people really worried about that? And then the other question is, domestically, do you feel pressure in Washington, since all of us are here in California. And what are you hearing in Washington? Are you concerned about that? I know that that was something that when we were at the department in the 1990s, we were really worried about disengagement. We were talking about troop presence, et cetera. What are you hearing now? What are you hearing now?
Well, thanks, Phil. Countries in the region are constantly scouring the headlines and watching TV news out of Washington for clues about America's sustainability and America's reliability as both a security partner and an economic partner, frankly, in the Asia-Pacific region. The tremendous energy revolution in the United States through shale gas and through unconventional energy sources as well as renewables has given a tremendous boost to U.S. credibility. And countries throughout the Asia-Pacific region want more engagement on energy, on climate change, on environment with the United States. They also have watched carefully to monitor the recovery of the U.S. economy. And they want a robust and an activist economic engagement with the United States. They are particularly fascinated and attracted by the spirit of innovation and entrepreneurship that I think the Bay Area is particularly known for. That is the very attractive side of the United States. And so the economic engagement, not only by big multinational corporations, but by small and medium-sized enterprises, the people-to-people engagement, travel back and forth, scientific exchange, academic and educational exchange, cultural exchange. This is hugely important and hugely reassuring in the region. Areas of concern now, though, I think, Phil, to be honest, have to do with what's happening or what's not happening in Washington. We have more than three dozen of my colleagues, career Foreign Service diplomats, who've been nominated to go out as an ambassador, not just in Asia, but globally, who've had their hearings in the Senate, but who haven't yet been finally confirmed. We've got a lot of vacancies out in the field. And as you know from your own diplomatic experience, you can't do diplomacy by long-distance calls. Even in an integrated and global world, you have to be there. You have to show that you care. And that's why Secretary Kerry and the President have put a tremendous amount of energy into persuading congressional leaders to try to get our men and women out into the field. Similarly, on the budget, although the allocations for our diplomatic programs and operations in the Asia-Pacific region have trended up recently, something that reflects the strategic priority of the President, the fact of the matter is that the amount of money that the United States spends in foreign assistance and in other programs that directly benefit the U.S. Is minuscule. And this is money well spent because we're sharing the planet with a lot of other people whose behavior, particularly on issues like climate change, will directly impact our future.
Okay. So, unfortunately, we've reached the point where there's only time for one last question. And I will take the prerogative of the chair, in a sense, to ask you. So you've had an opportunity to be with us for about an hour. And we've heard some great remarks, some enlightening remarks. What are the three things that you would like us to leave when we get out of here, when we leave this program, that you would like us to keep in mind?
Well, first and foremost, that America's engagement with the world, and particularly with the Asia-Pacific region, is not a matter that should be left to the professionals. This is something that we all have a stake in, and that everyone in their business, everyone in their life can contribute to through a variety of economic or academic or people-to-people programs. And I certainly encourage and urge each of you not only to engage personally, but also to provide support through your elected representatives for national programs that do this. Secondly, that what matters to the United States is goes far beyond what happens within the boundaries of the 50 states. In this very networked and global environment, problems in one area can come and will come to haunt us if we're not well configured. And so support for America's diplomats, support for America's national security institutions, including the military, isn't just a matter of paying tax once a year.
Okay. Our thanks to Danny Russell, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. We also want to thank our audience here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has also been held in association with the Asia Society of Northern California. I'm Philip Yun, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.